into the desert. There's a coyote on his car. And now he's digging. He just took some sort of ceremonial bracelet off of his neck.
Something I can't see.
He's building something with stones in the desert.
I can feel it.
And he's staring off into the vast prairie landscape.
It's magic.
It is hard to imagine that somebody thought that this ad was a good idea. But one thing I'm learning is that the discourse around Indigenous issues is very different in America than in Canada, and arguably it's something that more people are aware of and sensitive to here. One thing I've learned is that even the term Pretendians is far more widely known in Canada than in the States. We were at a podcast conference in LA, and we asked everybody we spoke to when we were talking about our new series, oh, do you know this term Pretendians? Do you know what a Pretendian is? Not one of the Americans we spoke to had heard of the term. So we're hoping to introduce the concept itself to as large an audience as possible. My concern as a publisher has been to make an engaging show that's going to do really well. Working with the two of you, your concern has been, okay, that sounds great, but we're not trying to turn this into a carnival because this matters. How is it sitting with you, and what is the goal of this from your perspective? Because we are not putting this in the important issue category. We are putting this on the, we're trying to put this on the main stage shopping mall, come check it out. There's a great new show, bingeable content over here. What's the best possible scenario, and what are the dangers of that?
I think the best case scenario is that some of the tools we use as Native folks, like our humor and our sarcasm and our perspective, does see Pretendians as kind of bonkers, and it looks kind of weird and funny to us. So I hope that people can take that vehicle and drive it to a good place, drive it to a spot where we actually start thinking about the humans behind the jokes, because some of these cases are insanely insidious, and it makes you wonder how people can ever do that to other people. And I think that there's a danger when it comes to using too much humor, but we live in a world that if you can't get someone's attention by whatever vehicle they like the most, then they'll never hear the message. So I don't mind being a person who cracks jokes about wannabe fakes and stuff like that. And I hope that that reaches someone who it doesn't necessarily reach before, because not everybody listens to the straight vegetables kind of diet of podcasts. It's not, some of us like our ice cream and our broccoli too.
Robert?
What I could say is that just so many of the stories have been trifling that you see in the press. They're just the same. There's too many of these damn stories about some academic or some damn person on TikTok or whatever. The stories are so inconsequential, and they're also low bar. They're always going after women. And in this series, we try and change that. And I guess, we're focusing on male Pretendians because those are the ones, the stories that no one's told. And those guys are, each of them, a problem. Now, if it's funny or not, I don't know. But I think probably one of the meanest things you could do to a man, one of the harshest things you could do to a man, is laugh at him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I really appreciate about this approach.
I think that's a big Native quality, though. That's kind of how I was raised, with humor. And the thing about humor is, when you can laugh in the face of something that terrifies you, you're taking your power back. You're diminishing the external threat and laughing at it and bringing that power back into yourself. And to me, humor is a great vessel for this kind of storytelling. And it signals to people that, hey, yeah, the joke is on these who just keep putting feathers in their headbands. It's so weird. I don't know why they do it. I don't know why you keep incentivizing them to do it. But we are just the Natives sitting back kind of laughing at their antics a lot of the times. And it's, yes, sometimes it takes opportunities away from us. But yeah, we have to stand up and take our power back. And one of the ways we do that is laugh at the offender.
If you're painting yourself up like an Oompa Loompa and putting on a feathered headdress and putting on the voice, the voice angel, right?
I was in the woods, and that's where I learned to tell the truth.
Yeah, I know you talk about the spirit and help you with the wind. Anyways, so when they put on that voice with the Oompa Loompa, makeup, a lot of them, for real, there's a lot of people with orange makeup, and dressed in the feathers. If you tell people it's okay to laugh at them, I think that pokes the hole That's the pinprick on the balloon of that sort of pretendianism that will take away some of its power.
Yeah, maybe laughter is the best medicine. I mean, people have to know what's going on first, and I think that's the job that you set out for yourselves with pretendians. But once they do have the information and can see it through your lens, it is really funny, and it deserves to be mocked. Robert, Angel, congratulations on Pretendians. Thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Mado.
I want to be the chief of my own destiny, to stand tall, to be free, and lead my tribe with dignity in the land of the brave, where spirits run deep. I want to be the chief. Don't wake me from this dream.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. Our website is CanadaLand.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Today's episode includes reporting from Robert Jago and Angel Ellis. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can listen to them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Journalist, author, teacher, Jan Wong, hello.
Hi.
Jan, today on the show, fact-checking the fact-checking of rappers. We will apply media criticism to the Kendrick-Drake beef. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Tonight, a serious shooting outside Drake's Toronto mansion. The rap feud between Drake and Kendrick Lamar is again dominating the internet.
It's the battle of the two hip-hop heavyweights you can dance to.
What could be the greatest rap beef of our time shows no signs of slowing down.
The two trading increasingly bitter diss tracks, some with serious allegations.
Jan, you're a Toronto musician, so I suspect you've, this is in your scene, you've been following the Drake-Kendrick beef pretty closely, I imagine?
Well, I'm less inclined to rap and closer to Mozart, but I sort of peripherally looked at it. I just know something about they were insulted because they have size 7 feet or something, which I thought, oh, I don't have time to do this. And I just want to say that there seems to be a death list of rappers who get killed by each other, but there's no list of harpsichordists who kill each other. So I think that's kind of intriguing. So let's talk about it.
What do you play again?
So I play flute, but I'm also learning cello. And I don't feel like killing anyone. It's very interesting.
That's not how I remember it. I remember you talking about some competition. Have you had any flute beefs and any issues with other flautists?
Yeah, flutes are really bad people. They're kind of nasty. They always want to say that they're greater than you are. So it's kind of like the rap world. So I sort of understand this whole Drake and Lamar thing a little bit. We do that in the flute section.
We could put a beat behind you there and start a whole thing. Jan Wong, I should start here with, you know the land acknowledgement thing?
Yes.
This is a dad acknowledgement. Nobody wants to hear my takes on this.
Oh.
As a 46-year-old white dad, my analysis of the Drake-Kendrick beef, like everybody is doing analysis of this. There are like hundreds and hundreds of people breaking this down.
I know, but yours will be different because you are a 46-year-old white dad. So I think we need your voice.
I agree. You know what? Okay, first of all, I just want to acknowledge by way of disclosure and framing here that, like, I want you to imagine that, like, the act of eye-rolling and cringing emits a low-frequency tone that's harmful to birds. If we can imagine that, Canadian geese are dropping from the skies right now. Like, I know that, and yet I am going to do this, and it's going to be really good, and people will have to acknowledge that not only did I get it right, but you're going to get analysis of this rap battle here that is more astute and thoughtful than you're going to get elsewhere. I'm throwing it down. Jana, can I educate you on the Kendrick Drake beef and what it means?
Please, please. You'll save me a lot of time.
All right. So first of all, who are these guys? And like this question, who's the better rapper? Which is what beefs traditionally are about, is who's number one. So who's the better rapper, Kendrick or Drake? That is an odd question to begin with. It's kind of like, who's the better songwriter, Bob Dylan or Billy Joel? Like, on the one hand, that's easy.
Yeah, I know. Bob Dylan, obviously.
On the other hand, what a weird exercise to compare Bob Dylan with Billy Joel. It's just a completely different thing. I mean, so Kendrick is our Bob Dylan in this analogy. He is a true artist. His best work has gravitas and depth.
And he won the Pulitzer.
Yes.
I'm shocked. I didn't even know until, you know, I looked him up.
The corollaries with our world of journalism are just going to reveal themselves one at a time here. I mean, the literary value and also the kind of chronicling aspect of Kendrick has been recognized. His masterpiece, To Pimp a Butterfly, it had this song on it that became the anthem of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's not unlike Blowin' in the Wind, which is not a good Dylan song, but still, it's a popular hit that's also a piece of poetry, but it captures the politics and the great themes of the moment. And then his next album gets the Pulitzer. What Kendrick represents to a lot of people is the evolution of hip-hop as a literary form, and, you know, but still with, like, respect and authenticity and a direct line from, like, Tupac Shakur to himself. He's got all the bona fides that you would need to be a respected rapper. You know, he's from Compton. He has street credibility. But he's also this critical darling with this real literary heft and political relevance. So that's Kendrick.
Okay.
And then you're Billy Joel here. Drake, he's a pop star. He's a hit maker.
He's a big hit maker, though.
Yes.
And he's Canadian.
Yes. And this is relevant here. So.
And he's my neighbor.
Do you live on the bridle path, Jan Wong?
I live in what real estate agents call bridle path adjacent.
Ah. You're adjacent to Conrad Black.
Conrad Black had to sell. He used to live across the street from Drake, and he had to sell because he needed money, and he sold for under asking.
Yeah, and then he rented his own house, which was a little bit...
He leased it back, yeah.
So Drake owns his house in the bridle path, and yes, his commercial success is part of the thing. But, you know, to give him his due beyond just saying that he's this big pop star, he does represent a different kind of evolution of hip-hop. He made it okay for rappers to not be from the streets. It's to talk about their emotions, their ennui, their sadness. Like, he's kind of emo. He made it okay to be an outsider in different ways. Yes, he's Canadian. He's also mixed. He's like a nice Jewish boy from Forest Hill.
Oh.
And he owns those things. He claims Canadianness and Toronto-ness. He put on the map the Toronto man accent, you know, which is really this kind of like cultural force that is Scarborough, this idea of this kind of multicultural center where all of these things intermingle. And that became really important for a lot of people. The fact that he became the number one rapper, even though he didn't have those bona fides, was really meaningful to mixed people or Canadian people. But then it gets spread out where, like, whether or not you're from Canada, most people who listen to hip-hop are not from that inner core of authenticity of hip-hop. And Drake came to represent all of the different things you can be and different kinds of blackness. In different ways, these two guys represented what hip-hop has become and what it has achieved. Previous to this battle, these guys were kind of like, they're sort of standard bearers for maturity of hip-hop culture.
Really? Because some of the lyrics that I've peripherally heard are kind of not very mature.
Well, you're talking about the actual exchange of diss tracks.
Yeah.
And this is where things have really degraded. Once they started exchanging these insults with each other, it devolved very rapidly from kind of schoolyard, you know, I'm a better rapper, or, you know, you have small feet, to you're a bad father.
Dear Adonis, I'm sorry that that man is your father. Let me be honest. It takes a man to be a man. Your dad is not responsive.
Okay, well, I'm a bad father. Well, you're not even the real father of your child.
I heard that one of them little kids might be day free.
And by the way, you beat your partner.
They hired a crisis management team to clean up the fact that you beat on your queen. The picture you paint, it ain't what it seemed.
And then, oh, I beat my partner. Well, that's better than being a pedophile.
Certified lover boys, certified pedophiles.
What I want to start with, Jan, is the journalistic quality that this battle has taken. Like, here's some actual lyrics that Drake threw at Kendrick. You got to learn to fact check things and be less impatient.
You got to learn to fact check things and be less impatient.
Sounds like my editor.
These are things that you might say to your students, Jan.
Yeah.
Your J school students. Drake insults Kendrick's sourcing. He says your sources are clowns. You're not speaking to the right people.
The ones that you're getting your stories from, they are clowns.
Where's your paperwork?
Where's the paperwork of the cabinet is filed in?
He says you got to stop doing your research on TikTok.
TikTok videos you collected and dissected instead of being on some disdirect shit.
It's not just about insults. It's about I have dirt on you. And this sort of started back when another rapper, Pusha T, who like keeps files. He has like opposition research on his opponents. And he revealed at an earlier moment that Drake had this unclaimed son. Well, that was true. It's like crisis communications. It's like stuff Navigator would do. So Kendrick comes at Drake and says, well, you have another child. You've got a daughter that you haven't claimed.
Well, I would like to say it's not your fault that he's hiding another child.
And Drake goes, aha, you fell for it. We fed you that misinformation to see if you would actually check your sources, and you didn't.
We plotted for a week, and then we fed you the information. A daughter that's 11 years old, I bet he takes it. We thought about giving a fake name or a destination, but you so thirsty, you not concerned with investigation.
Gee, I should pay more attention to this. It's great.
It's wildly entertaining, and it has spawned a cottage industry of analysis. Like, a lot of these are very deeply layered disses. Like, the names of the tracks have four different meanings, and there's insinuations.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this just marketing, though?
You could look at it that way, and certainly there's, like, one of the many, many theories out there about this is that these guys have kind of peaked, and this is a way they could leverage their fame to keep their names on everyone's lips a little bit longer. I think that theory only goes so far because it's impossible to imagine that they're calling up each other after this and saying, let's coordinate our marketing efforts here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really ugly. And the Drake stuff is like, this has been swirling around Drake's camp for years, these allegations of, you know, sex with minors and even sex trafficking. And I wouldn't even mention it because it was not something that we could ever validate. The only kind of verified aspects of it were that, like, this Drake associate, Baca, had a human trafficking charge against him years ago that was dropped. And there's like a concert video where Drake is on stage with like a young woman and he's being a bit inappropriate with her. But these kind of like allegations were swirling around. But now Drake has acknowledged the accusation from Kendrick and said, you know, this lazy Epstein angle that you took.
Speaking of anything with a child, let's get to that now. This Epstein angle was the I expected.
Now that's kind of like on the radar in a way that's being examined. So we're getting into kind of like allegations of criminal activity. So I can't imagine that's part of, like, you know, any kind of consensual marketing effort.
And, of course, the shooting.
And then we get to the shooting. It reminds me of, like, a Pizzagate thing where, on the one hand, you know, news coverage of the shooting, a lot of Kendrick's fans got annoyed that Kendrick was even mentioned, you know, as if Kendrick was somehow responsible.
He put the bridal path aerial shot on the cover of whatever he just released, right? So he was like, here's the map. In Lamar's defense, you can find Drake's house easily. And he opened his doors to Architectural Digest and Toronto Life. So no privacy.
See, I thought I was going to teach you something. I can't teach you nothing. That's exactly right. So yeah, he used the kind of the overhead shot. And Drake kind of said, like, big deal, like, I publicized my house. But Kendrick put these icons on the house, which are the kind of signifiers that police use on, like, sex offender maps.
That went right over my head until I read the news reports later.
Yeah, so I think it's one of these things where I don't think there's any reason at this point to believe that Kendrick had any direct involvement with this shooting. And there was, you know, earlier this week in the middle of the night, a security guard was shot in front of Drake's mansion in a drive-by, non-life-threatening but serious injuries. This strikes me more as likely like a Pizzagate thing where, you know, if you've got millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people getting very emotionally involved in this very ugly, bitter conflict, all you need is like one person who's unhinged to begin with to be like, I'm going to do something about this. It's more of a modern phenomenon where online vitriol gets so heated and is so widely dispersed that people basically radicalize themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be that you're a member of an organization.
The strange thing is, I walked over there just to check it out because your producer told me I was going to be too lazy if I didn't get off my butt and actually look. So I walked over there.
You did field reporting? You did field reporting for this segment.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I walked over and I'm the only one on the sidewalk because no one actually walks in the bridle path, right? And I talked to the media because they had nobody to talk to. So it's a strange neighborhood. It's a neighborhood where everybody has really high fences, and Drake's fences are twice the height of everyone else's, and he grows these bushes on top of the tallest fence. That's what I found most intriguing, because the only way to trim those bushes is to get a crane or a cherry picker. So it's ostentatious fence building. But what I found out was that the night of the shooting, there was a young guy in a car outside Drake's house, blasting his sound system at Drake's house because he's a writer. He wants to get famous. He wants Drake to notice him.
Uh-huh.
And so he was blasting this in the night, and I think somebody tried it because somebody in the neighborhood said, can you please shut up? And so he turned off the music. He moved his car, but he didn't leave. He just sat there outside Drake's house, and he saw the shooting. Then the shooter came. Yeah. This is good stuff.
So there was an aspiring rapper,
yes,
who wanted to be discovered by Drake. He wanted the Drake effect. He wanted Drake to sign him on. And because he was there in this very obnoxious way, he actually was an eyewitness to the shooting.
Yeah.
Is this like breaking news? Has this been reported yet?
Well, the Star reported. He wouldn't give his name, but he said he talked to the police.
Okay.
Reuters photographer told me this too. There was a Reuters. And then I went back and I checked it, right? Because I am a fact checker. So I checked it, and this guy who didn't give his name has talked to the police. Said he heard the shots, he was freaked out, and then he saw this car, you know, whiz by. He didn't say whether it was a drive-by shooting or whether the shooter had gotten out of the car, but he said he heard the shots, and then he saw the car drive northbound, because that's the only way to get out of the bridle path. It's this funny little enclave.
Uh-huh.
And it's called the Bridle Path, if you want more trivia, because E.P. Taylor used to have a horse farm there. But nobody else listening to this knows who E.P. Taylor is, so we'll just move right along.
I expect E.P. Taylor to be worked into the next diss track. Well done, Jan. I guess I want to like leave this just by saying like a lot of people are enjoying this battle. It's exciting, waiting for the next one to come out and parsing it.
Yeah.
I think ultimately this is really sad. Adrian Lee in The Globe wrote, in the beef between Drake and Kendrick Lamar, no one's a winner. I agree with this because, like, as delicious as it is to take your side and pick your favorite and research this stuff and consume all the media about it, these are two really excellent people who have accomplished quite a bit and mean a lot to a lot of people, just degrading each other with everything they can, just trying to destroy each other with the most vicious personal insults. And I don't really care that much about each of them. I mean, whatever, I'm Team Kendrick as a rap fan, but...
Oh, you are?
Oh, yeah, Kendrick's great. Like, there's no question.
Okay.
But there are these racial overtones to it. And one of the things that Kendrick's insults to Drake has kind of achieved is, like, whatever permission you had from hip-hop to be you, I'm revoking it. And one of the tracks is called Not Like Us.
Oh.
And he's sort of like playing this card of like, no, you're not authentic and you don't have permission to use the N-word because the implication being you're not really black.
Oh, that's bad.
It's regressive.
No, that's no good.
There was room for a complicated figure like Drake, or just a different, like somebody who reflected a different kind of blackness. And he's sort of saying, uh-uh, we're done. We don't trust you. You're not like us. And Kendrick is brutal, and he's very funny, and he actually mimics the Toronto accent. It's like you're watching one of your rap heroes make fun of the way that you talk. In a way that, like, before all of this, the way that you talk was actually, like, not only okay, but accepted, you know, the very specific Toronto slang.
What's wrong with Toronto? I don't understand how you could even make fun of someone who speaks with a Toronto accent.
Kendrick does a pretty good job of it.
Tell me you're cheesing, farmer. We could do this right now on the camera, Crody.
Well, I can't understand him just to, like, put one up for the Toronto team. I can't understand any of this rap stuff. I need subtitles. That's what we do in opera.
You'll find it on TikTok.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I don't really watch rap on TikTok.
Closed captioning on TikTok. It's also sad on the other end of it if Kendrick meant something to you in terms of, like, you know, like Drake's going after Kendrick as a fake activist, whatever he meant to the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, tearing him down and reminding people of, like, domestic abuse stuff. If it mattered to you that Kendrick was somebody to be respected, this is degrading to you too, you know, like everyone's getting hurt here.
I was just going to say that you're getting all upset because you're really into this. But I would say a lot of people would just be on the periphery, and it's okay. You know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Now I know who Lamar is. I didn't even know who he was. And I went, he won a Pulitzer? When did I miss this? So I think you're feeling bad because you care about rap. But for people who don't care about rap, it's a good thing because now we've heard of them, right?
I guess so.
They've got real mainstream, like, and I mean not just that demographic mainstream, but people who don't pay any attention now are paying attention. So I think it's okay. I think they will survive. They've got a load of money.
Yes.
I think it will be okay.
I'll say this about it, and I'll flip what you just said, because I think you're right. If you have no emotional investment in this work, it's just entertainment. But there's a large demographic of people who don't follow the news. You know, we know that people age into news readership in their 30s. And maybe they've been spared, a lot of them, from, like, the current divisive climate where there's, like, you know, conflict that you must take a side on. You have, the neutrality is not an option.
Good point.
And this is now, like, just another major point of division and acrimony where, like, there's no choice to sit it out. Like, you are on one team or the other, and you must take a side. And that sort of reflects an ugliness of the moment, too. Jan, that's your cuts. It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
It was so much fun. Thanks.
And I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything people send. Jan, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter. It's still called Twitter to me. And it's at Writer Wong.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Drawing, dancing, making music. These forms of expression are not just for people who identify as artists. Sarah Newman of the Climate Mental Health Network says they can help people explore their feelings about climate change.
This is not asking people to show up and become Pablo Picasso. This is about using different modalities to process your emotions.
For many people, thinking about climate change can provoke anxiety, anger, or fear. So Newman's group provides resources, primarily for parents and teachers, to help young people identify and cope with these emotions. It offers a free art therapy guide in English and Spanish. The guide suggests activities such as making collages with images that reflect what you're feeling about climate change, or dancing and moving your body to release difficult emotions.
art therapy is a way to express one's emotions in a way that is beyond the limitations of words. And it's a way to tap into experiences and feelings that you might be having or that you might not even necessarily fully recognize.
So art can help people begin to process the many emotions evoked by the climate crisis. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.